Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage's completely online process lets you get a custom mortgage solution wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In words and deeds, things are getting hot between the United States and Russia. Pick your front. On Friday, the U.S. officially accused Russia of hacking the coming presidential election. Secretary of State John Kerry accused Russia of war crimes in Syria. Russian officials lately telling the U.S. don't you dare attack Moscow's ally Syria, and moving in missiles to back up the threat. This hour on Point, Russia and the U.S. on tense new ground. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see going on, going wrong in this relationship? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at the Philippines and its new president's threats to move away from the U.S. and into the arms of China. But first, we turn to Josh Meyer in Washington for the latest on the Russian hacking story in the U.S. elections. He's senior investigative reporter focusing on national security for NBC's News Investigations Unit. Josh Meyer, great to have you back. Welcome.
Great to be back. Thanks, Tom.
What exactly did the U.S. allege last week that Moscow is doing around and to U.S. elections and campaigning?
Well, we were waiting for the shoe to drop for a while. The government insisted that it was doing its due diligence and aggressively investigating this. And so finally on Friday, the Obama administration, through a release by the Directorate of National Intelligence and the Department of Homeland Security, squarely blamed Russia and President Vladimir Putin for a wave of hacking attacks and email leaks basically aimed at interfering with the U.S. election process. So it was a pretty heavy accusation. Some believe that it actually triggers a response by the U.S. government, leading all the way up to military response just by making the accusation.
What do you mean it triggers a response? That there's a response already underway? Like what?
Well, I think that there very well could be and may have been for some time now. A lot of this stuff is done in the classified realm and very clandestine. You might remember that against Iran, we unleashed a thing called the Stuxnet virus, which burrowed into their centrifuges. But in the public sense, there are presidential directives and other things that require an escalation of response in response to particular acts. And so when we make a formal attribution that a foreign government is hacking into the United States, official infrastructure, that can trigger some kind of response by the U.S. government.
I want to get a gritty.
There are other people that say that that's a too direct reading, and that they have enough leeway so that they don't actually have to do anything.
We'll look at a response or potential responses. I want to get a grittier sense of what's being alleged here. We go all the way back to the Democratic National Convention when there were. Suddenly, here was all kinds of email traffic from internal conversations that Democrats had had. Democrats said that's Moscow. The U.S. did not make this formal allegation at that time. Has there been more since then? What else is in the pile they're pointing to say Moscow did that, Putin did that?
A lot of this is based on forensic evidence gathered through, various means, intelligence collection, federal law enforcement. The investigation into this is being led by the FBI, but it's a very aggressive multi-agency investigation. And what they're saying is that based on forensic analysis, that hackers working for the Kremlin essentially were stealing this information and then leaking it strategically to WikiLeaks and to DCLeaks.com, which is a website that they have linked, they believe, to the Russian government, and releasing the emails at a time in which they would be most embarrassing and help influence American politics in the direction that they wanted to go. And so they were very clear in this statement, saying that they believe that the Russian government is doing this to, influence the American election. They stopped short of saying exactly what they specifically are trying to do and whether they're trying to help get Trump elected at the expense of Hillary Clinton. But it came very close to saying that.
Hillary Clinton was not reluctant to go in that direction on Sunday night in the town hall presidential debate. Here she was.
We have never in the history of our country been in a situation where an adversary, a foreign power, is working so hard to influence the outcome of the election. And believe me, they're not doing it to get me elected.
Josh Myers with us from NBC News. He's following all of this. Josh, if we look forward to November 8th, are there also allegations that Russia has taken steps that could actively interfere with the voting itself, not just the campaign environment?
Well, that's the concern, yeah. And I think that the statement on Friday has echoed what other people have been saying privately, and what we believe is hopeful and wishful thinking, that this will not have any kind of impact on the election. In fact, the statement said that even though they are targeting the election system, including at least 20 attempted hacks of state election systems and 2 successful intrusions in Illinois and Arizona, that, quote, it would be extremely difficult for someone, including a nation-state actor, to alter actual ballot counts or election results by cyber attack or intrusion. What they're not saying there is that there's a lot of other ways they could mess with the election. They could create some sort of fake documents. They could mess with social media. They could hack into, the internet streams that are tallying the vote counts from the precinct level up to the state level, although many of those are encrypted. They could also just sow enough confusion and discord so that people demand a recount, and that could be a big problem because in a few states at least, including 1 or 2 strategic ones, there's no ability to do a recount based on the electronic nature of the voting machines.
So you say they couldn't alter, the U.S. government is asserting, but what about just knock out if we just didn't have results from some significant state? Is that possible to do with a cyber attack, with a hack?
Yes, they're very, very concerned about that. That's another thing that has been bubbling up to the surface is they are not just, and the intel community has known this for a long time, of course, but that they're not just hacking into the election system. They're hacking into the power grid. They're sort of, as the term that's coming to the fore now is that they're preparing the battlefield, which means that they're basically burrowing into all sorts of critical infrastructure systems, including the power grid, for the purposes of taking it down if and when they need to. Whether they'll be successful and whether we could get it back up and running immediately is another question. But intel officials point to the Ukraine, where last year Russia essentially took out the power grid for about a very significant regional area for quite some time.
How big a deal is this?
That could happen here.
How big a deal is this formal allegation made by the U.S. government on Friday in terms of, I mean, you say it could trigger even a required response of some kind that we may or may not ever know about it. How often does this kind of thing happen? How big a deal is this, Josh?
Oh, I don't know if it's unprecedented, but it's certainly close to that if it isn't already. I mean, whether or not it forces a attribution or a response, I mean, I think that there's enough leeway built into these presidential directives and other policy, frameworks so that we don't literally have to do something, but I think it essentially puts the government in a position where if they don't do something, they have crossed a red line and at which they've said they're going to respond. And then if they don't, it sort of, creates problems down the line for when we respond and when we don't. But again, the response could be anything from, a military response, which nobody thinks is going to happen, to sanctions or, even indicting and trying to prosecute, alleged perpetrators like we did with the Chinese, to just naming and shaming, even to some of this clandestine stuff with, through the internet. So there's a very, broad range of responses that we can engage in, and I'm sure that at least some of that is ongoing already.
If it were a physical military attack, I mean, typically there's a counterattack. With a cyber attack, are there good options for the U.S. in terms of a counterattack that they might even be carrying out now?
A couple of people in the intel community have told me that there's really no good options here. We have to be very careful because we have probably the best cyber capabilities anywhere, but we're also very vulnerable in this wired world that we live in. They could come after us and they could take down, like we were discussing, the power grid. They could take down, they could change the voter registration rolls so that when people show up to the polls, their names aren't on there. They could change the addresses so people show up in the wrong place. I mean, there's a lot of things that they could do that would cause a lot of serious problems. I mean, and, it's worth noting that these same actors from the Russian government hacked into the White House and the non-classified section of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and also the State Department. So they're burrowed in pretty much everywhere. And I wrote a story on Saturday about how the hacks aren't just of the Democrats, it's about the Republicans and everybody else that they deem of some strategic value to Russia.
In the old Cold War that we all ardently wish to leave behind, there was the nuclear threat. Of course, it's still there, but then it was vivid in
The counter was that mutually assured destruction. Do this to us and we'll do this to you. You described the vulnerabilities of the U.S. Are those universal? I mean, would Russia restrain at some point? Because if everybody let loose their cyber guns, you'd have power grids and dams and stuff failing all over the place. Is that a break on them going too far, whatever that means?
Well, I mean, it's a very good question. I think when you had nuclear weapons as the primary instrument of projecting power and defending your own interests, nobody thought that Russia or the United States would be crazy enough to unleash that. The problem with cyber is that it's much more of there's many more gradations of it, so that you could start at a small level and then things could escalate. So the problem is that you could do something that you think is fairly reasonable, hacking into their system with Stuxnet or whatever, and that could sort of create the kind of escalation that gets out of control. So, I mean, there's some very serious consequences here. I'm sure that this is being discussed at the various highest levels of the administration and Congress almost on a daily basis about what to do about this.
Is there a point?
Yeah, it's a huge concern.
Is there a point at which, or maybe this was Friday, is there a point at which Americans would understand? I mean, toying with a presidential election, that's kind of the heart of our system. Is there a point, right, at which you get to a declaration of what's a Pearl Harbor in cyber terms?
Well, I don't know if this gets close to a Pearl Harbor, but one thing that I was told by several sources was that this the statement that was put out Friday, literally every single word of this was negotiated to death, because they had to be very, very careful about not going too far, but also, going far enough so that the states actually, really understand what's going on here and try to bolster their cyber defenses. Russia in other countries has done much worse. I mean, they've used cyber capabilities alongside military capabilities.
We're looking at exactly what's going on here and why. We're going to dive deeper into that. Josh Meyer at NBC News, thank you so much for being with us today, Josh.
My pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about this U.S.-Russia moment. New tensions all over in Syria, in hacking, in a war of words and threats that start to seem all too real. You can join us this hour. Are you watching all this unfold? Are you worried? Are you following all the points of tension here? And in an unstable time domestically, globally, could this blow up? Are we blowing back to some kind of Cold War standoff or to something hotter, where we don't know the rules, something strange and new? Last Friday, Secretary of State John Kerry, after the collapse of the U.S.-Russian deal over Syria, and after Syrian airstrikes had targeted a couple of hospitals in Aleppo, after many other civilian targets have been hit, ratcheted up the words, signaled a worsening of relations with Russia. Here was Kerry saying this was beyond accidental and talking war crimes.
Russia and the regime owe the world more than an explanation about why they keep hitting hospitals and medical facilities and children and women. These are acts that beg for an appropriate investigation of war crimes.
War crimes. Keep that phrase in mind. Here from the Moscow side, Russian Defense Ministry spokesperson, this is Igor Konashenkov, last week warning the U.S. not to target Syrian government forces. He said Russian air defense missiles now on the ground in Syria are capable, react in split seconds, and the U.S. Air Force, he said, should watch out.
I would like to remind the American strategists that the air cover of the Russian bases in Khmeimim and Tartus is provided by the S-400 and S-300 anti-aircraft weapons systems, the strike radius of which may be a surprise to any unidentified flying objects. I should really acknowledge that the Russian anti-aircraft defenses won't likely have time to figure out through a direct line where the weapon's going or who it belongs to.
And on the U.S. side, not directly citing Russia, but here, just to give you a flavor of what's being said out there, this is Army Chief of Staff Mark Milley give a fiery speech on the Russia-U.S. conflict over Syria at the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting last week. Four-star general said the U.S. military is ready to take on any enemy. Here he was.
The United States military, despite all our challenges, despite our op tempo, despite everything we've been doing, will stop you and we will beat you harder than you've ever been beaten before. Make no mistake about that. And we will destroy any enemy, anywhere, anytime.
Talk and action out there. Joining us now from London is Bjorn Kornblum. Served in a number of high-level diplomatic posts with a focus on Russia and Europe, former Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, now based in Berlin, senior counselor to the international law firm Knorr LLP. John Kornblum, thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to be with you.
And from Washington, Angela Stent is here, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council. Angela Stent, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be on your show again.
John Kornblum, what do you make of the level of bumping up against one another here and the rhetoric? How much of this is just theater? Are we in a serious new era of potential confrontation?
Well, one tries to take it all with a grain of salt, but I'm forced to say that it's starting to get a little bit worrisome. The United States and Russia have been through similar confrontations in the past, which were more smoke than fire. The problem is, especially in Syria, and the Russian defense minister made the point that you're not really sure what's going on there. And weapons could start going in the wrong direction and hit the Americans or hit the Russians and cause a big explosion, and we could be in a very difficult situation. We've been neglecting our relationship with Russia for several years, really ever since the end of the Clinton administration. And now we are finding that Russia is not as malleable and not as easy to deal with as we thought, and it's turning into a big confrontation.
I mean, take us down the list here, and what's serious and what maybe isn't, but we've got Syria, where you heard the Russian defense ministry spokesman there saying, hey, if our missiles go off, we don't know who they're going to hit. You know, message could be you, USA, I guess. You've got the allegation from Washington of Russia hacking into America's really most profound democratic exercise, maybe, or certainly the most high profile, the presidential election. We've got these overflights in the Baltic where they come within feet of American forces, Russian warplanes. We've got Putin saying we're pulling out of the deal to mop up plutonium, which was a major point of cooperation there. I mean, maybe I'm missing other points of tension, but that's already quite a list, John.
I give you a number of others if you wanted to.
Yes,
there
please.
Are many. There's Ukraine, for example.
Of course.
There's the whole situation in the Baltic states. There's still the situation in Afghanistan. There are many problems. The problem that we have right now is that they're starting to get very, very critical. Syria is the one that's the most critical in my own view. But secondly, our channels of communication, our ongoing dialogue, our understanding of the personalities in Russia and their understanding with us has really almost eroded, I won't say to nothing, Angela can say more to that perhaps, but it's gone way down from where it was, say, 20 years ago. The United States tends to believe that when a war is over, it's over. So when the Cold War was over, we really ratcheted back our diplomacy in Europe, in Russia, in all the areas which we thought had been taken care of. And we're now paying a price for that. We just don't have the soldiers say we don't have the boots on the ground. Well, we don't have the pinstripe suits on the ground either. We just don't have the people out there who need to be doing the diplomacy.
Angela Stent, when you look across this horizon of tensions, conflicts, potential flashpoints even, I guess, what looks most serious to you, and what does it add up to your mind, in terms of the seriousness of this new chapter we seem to be in?
We certainly, I think, are seeing a U.S.-Russian relationship that's worse than it's been at any time since before Gorbachev came to power, and you could even argue that during the Brezhnev era, as you yourself made reference to mutually assured destruction, mm-hmm. John Kornblum was talking about diplomacy. Even in those days, there were channels of communication, and there was acceptance of rules of the game. I think we have no rules of the game that we and the Russians basically can say we subscribe to anymore, because we look at a Russia that seems very unpredictable to us. I think the situation in Syria is potentially very dangerous because, as we heard from the Russian defense ministry spokesman, we both have aircraft operating there. We
yeah.
do still maintain, we're trying to deconflict our air operations. But, if something's go unanticipated happens and an aircraft is shot down, I mean, then what do we do? Then we really are facing, you know, how do we pull back from that? And then I think the situation with our own election is serious because Putin genuinely believes that the U.S. has been trying to unseat his government, that Hillary Clinton was behind the demonstrations against him in 2011. And so his message is, we can do this to you. You tried to do it to us. And B, his message to the rest of the world is, look at the hypocrisy of the United States trying to preach to us about democracy. Look what goes on in the DNC and look even what goes on in the presidential debates. And I think it's too, it's really reasserting Russia and saying, you, the United States, haven't taken us seriously, haven't respected us for 25 years, and this is what you get now. And I think there is an element of unpredictability there. We don't know what the rules of the game are, and we do, as John Kornblum said, have very few channels of communication that work. You did have the Kerry Lavrov channel, and you still have that, but that's seriously frayed.
I mean, this could be John Kornblum revenge or reaction to steps that the U.S. has taken or the way the world unfolded after the fall of the Soviet Union. But if it's not just revenge or reaction, how do you read the strategic intent of, I think it's fair to say, Russia's escalation of these tensions?
Yeah. Well, I think there are many levels to it. And the ones you mentioned are all true. And again, there are others, including Putin's own personality, his sense of loss with the loss of the Soviet Union and his desire to build up a Russian empire again. And Russia is always complicated. And there, you can go back 300 years of writing about how complicated it is to understand Russia. But in this case, you have a combination of an internal situation which is not doing well. The economy is not doing well. The political system, they just had a so-called election, which everybody agreed there was not much of an election. They have difficulties around them in many areas. They have a population which is looking for a standard of living, and the oil price has gone down. And then you have, in fact, this sense. I was at the famous Putin outburst at the Munich Security Conference in 2007. Mm-hmm. I think Angela was too. Mm-hmm. And he just, you could just see it. It was like having a 16-year-old son who was just telling you everything was wrong. And the problem is that the United States and the Western Europeans just sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, well, there he goes. You know, we didn't really take it very seriously. And so in a way, and I in no way want to justify anything that Putin is doing, but in a way, we're also reaping what we have sown, which is not paying much attention to what Russia is doing. China was important. Middle East was important. Many other things were important. And we thought that Russia was just, the president called them a regional power, which in many ways they are. But they're a very difficult and also a very regional power which can damage us very much.
People may not have paid attention, but they're paying attention now. President Obama, in his address to the UN General Assembly 3 weeks ago, talked about two big tides of history, democracy and authoritarianism. Democracy is flawed, he said, but, and this sounds like talking to Moscow, authoritarianism, said Obama, leads to war.
History shows that strong men are then left with two paths. Permanent crackdown, which sparks strife at home, or scapegoating enemies abroad, which can lead to war.
Angela Stent, how do you look strategically at what's going on in Moscow right now and their sense of the world?
Well, I think there are two things going on. One of them is we see, even though there's a lot that we don't understand about what's happening in inner circles, if you look at what President Putin has done in the last few months in terms of shuffling personnel, getting rid of older people, bringing in younger men who are all loyal to him, then he's contending with a declining economy, growth rates falling mainly as a result of Russia's own economic mismanagement and falling oil prices and the sanctions. And he's looking towards the 2018 presidential election, which some people think he's going to move up now. So we can look at his poll numbers and say, wow, you know, he's so popular. What's he worried about? But one gets the sense, looking at this and talking to Russians, that there's some profound sense also there that he needs to shore up his popularity, ensure that he gets reelected, and prevent any more popular unrest against him or a palace coup against him, which, you know, in Russian history has happened several times. So I think there's this mixture of Russia trying to reassert its world role, say we're a global power, you have to respect us, we have to be involved in all important decisions, but then a profound questioning of what's happening domestically in Russia, because Russia is not modernizing. It hasn't taken the economic steps it should have taken to become a modern economy. It's still mainly a petrostate, and it looks around, it looks at China and some of the other neighbors, particularly in Asia, and it sees them growing. So you have this this contradiction here, if you like, and then this determination that Russia is going to take, you know, full advantage of its own ability to dominate its neighborhood militarily, which we've seen. But I think there's also a sense in Russia that the U.S. is a declining power and that Russia wants to seize this moment, particularly now before our presidential election, to do whatever it can to strengthen its own position.
John, maybe this is a coup against the sort of multilateral system where the U.S. was or was presumed for a long time to be the leader. I mean, we're hearing here all these comments about democracy and its ineffectual problems from Moscow. I'm reading here Jochen Bittner of Die Zeit in Germany writing about Putin putting up an alternative way of governance to challenge democracy. Jochen calls it orderism, kind of authoritarianism, and saying, look, this is the better model. Democracy is a mess. Come with me, Poland. Come with me, Turkey. Come with me, Philippines.
Well, this is a situation that we've been in before where democracies, especially when they're going through times of change and times of trouble, have a very hard time dealing with authoritarian leaders because authoritarian leaders can say things and do things. Democracies, as we know, have parliaments and press and elections and everything else. The West is in the middle of a profound economic change, the third industrial revolution, as some people call it. This is extremely profound, and it's one of the reasons that our own election campaign is so unsettled as it is.
It does Russia look like a mess sometimes.
Well, it is a mess. I think it probably is a mess. But, you know, there's something called constructive destruction. We're yep. going into a new era.
Mm-hmm.
And as Angela pointed out, Russia seems to have done none of this. I was at a conference in Berlin this week in honor of Boris Nemtsov, who was killed, as we know, last year. And it was filled with, shall we say, independent Russian academicians, including economists.
There is such
and
a
most
thing?
Of them, many, many of them, yes, mm-hmm. and they were fascinating people.
Mm-hmm.
And they all came, they all stressed that they didn't believe the Russian economy would be moving one iota, one inch in the next 10 or 15 years, and in fact would probably be going backwards. So Putin, as Angela said, is facing on the one hand a rapidly worsening economic situation. He is facing a world which may look disorderly to him and maybe to many of us, which was actually regrouping around a new whole system of digitalization and globalization. He is also looking at a Chinese neighbor. We should mention China here.
Mm-hmm.
China is not exactly a great democracy, but it is a major competitor to Russia and, in the views of Russia, a major threat because it has gone through much of the digital revolution that Russia has not. So the strategic position of Russia actually looks quite bad. And the strategic position of Putin in his own economic and political situation is not much better. So striking out, as the president said, striking out is one way that people have used over the centuries to deal with their own internal problems.
Is it strategically worth it if Russia's not taking that bridge to the 21st century to try and blow up somebody else's bridge, to take advantage of the vulnerabilities that you suggest are there because of the economic transformation underway in many countries around the world, the U.S. included?
Yes, well, it might be. And again, we don't know, at least I don't know. And I think Angela is a better voice on this than I am.
Angela?
We don't know about his mental state. That's the thing we should think about.
I mean, I think in the long run, things do not look good for Russia if Russia doesn't take the steps that John's been talking about, really to join the modern world economically. And it's not only economically, it's politically too. I mean, there are political institutions in Russia, but they aren't that important. Russia still functions very much on a kind of personalistic, the technical term is neo-patrimonial system where, you know, everyone around him depends on the leader for their, you know, continuing well-being and continuing in office. And you need to move, but you know, you need to build modern political institutions as well as a modern economy.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings home financing into the 21st century with a completely online process that's fast, easy, and convenient. Using a phone or tablet, you can safely share bank statements and pay stubs without having to dig through piles of paperwork. It takes just a few minutes to get a custom mortgage solution on your terms, wherever and whenever you want. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about this U.S.-Russia moment. New tensions all over in Syria, in hacking, in a war of words, and threats that start to seem all too real. Angela Stent is with us from Georgetown University. John Kornblum, longtime U.S. diplomat on the European, Eastern European front, now at NOR LLP, joining us today from London. He's based these days in Berlin. You can join us this hour as well. Is it time for the U.S. to toughen up with Russia? Is Donald Trump right? Is it time to learn to love Putin, to team up with Russia? In a moment, we're going to turn to the Philippines, where the leader's talking about turning to the arms of China there across the South China Sea. Russia came up in the presidential debate on Sunday night. Here was Donald Trump saying the U.S. and Russia can work together to fight ISIS. He distanced himself from the man he's praised so often, Vladimir Putin, and disavowed any business dealings with Russia.
I think it would be great if we got along with Russia because we could fight ISIS together as an example. But I don't know, Putin. I know nothing about Russia. I know about Russia, but I know nothing about the inner workings of Russia. I don't deal there. I have no businesses there. I have no loans from Russia.
What's the U.S. approach here? Mike Pence said in the vice presidential debate, if things went too far, the U.S. should be in there militarily. Donald Trump saying no, no, no in the debate on Sunday night, all over the place.
If Russia continues to be involved in airstrikes along with the Syrian government forces of Assad, the United States of America should be prepared to use military force to strike the military targets of the Assad regime.
Okay. He and I haven't spoken, and I disagree. I disagree.
You disagree with your running mate.
I think we have to knock out ISIS.
Martha Raddatz there quoting Mike Pence, and then Donald Trump saying, well, we haven't talked about it. I disagree. John, how do you see the Trump candidacy figuring into the Russian view of the U.S. right now?
Well, if I were an analyst sitting in Moscow looking at the United States situation, I'd say they don't have any policy. Because we have to remember that both Obama, one of the reasons that he was very reticent in Syria, and I assume some of the much more positive statements that Trump made about Putin in the recent mm-hmm. weeks has been based on the assumption that the American people don't want to get involved in the world. And this is based on fatigue, on anger, on sadness over the large military interventions we had, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And so the general political analysis is Americans don't want to be involved. I think that's what it is. Secondly, however, you have parts of the Republican Party, Mr. Pence seems to reflect them, who say, let's go out there and shoot everybody down again like Americans always do, the sort of, the Fort Custer mm-hmm. kind of thing.
Yep.
Then you have the liberal establishment, which crosses the party lines, both Republican and Democrats. And, I guess people like Angela and I are part of that also, who believe in a steady diplomacy with engagement, but not always intervention. This is where Hillary Clinton stands, I think. In other words, you see what I mean. You got four mm-hmm. or five different approaches to what the United States thinks should be going on in the world. And from where I sit in Berlin, people are asking me all the time, well, what exactly is it that you want to do? And I sort of say sometimes, well, I wish I knew. So if you're sitting there in Moscow and seeing all this, what does it do? If you're Putin, it says, wow, this is a great opportunity for me to cause some trouble.
Russia working it. Michael is calling from Kharkiv in the Ukraine. Michael, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing, Tom?
Okay, what do you see?
I've been a journalist out here for several years, and I covered Maidan Revolution and some of the war. I'm only about 35 miles from the Russian border here, mm-hmm. and this was, also taken over in the whole Donbass kind of insurrection and, yep. and then invasion. And Putin's going to keep pushing until somebody pushes back. Obama, I'm a big Obama supporter, but his whole behavior in this has been really tragic. You know, he telegraphed he wasn't going to do anything about Ukraine and that it was Russia's sphere of influence, and that encouraged Putin to go into the Donbass. I mean, you know, not a single shot was fired in the whole invasion of Crimea. And so he thought, okay, look, it was bloodless. I can just keep going. I can keep going. And he's doing the same thing in Syria. You know, I mean, first, I mean, the Russians have never, ever fought in the Middle East ever. That was really a red line. And the idea that, oh, well, they'll get bogged down and they'll be trapped in this endless thing and then get be bombed and have all the same kind of horrors that we've had is kind of foolish because we, you know, the Russians are much, much more ruthless than we ever have been.
What's the right U.S. answer here, Michael? What's the right American answer?
I don't know. It's tremendous. Now, you know, it's almost too late now that they are in Syria. I think really when they bombed the that aid convoy, you know, we should have sent a couple of cruise missiles into the lower floors of Assad's mansion or taken out all their helicopters or planes. I mean, you know, that's the only thing Russia respects and certainly what Assad respects. I mean, the guy is really a thug. I mean, there's no real solution in Syria because if we overthrew Assad, there would probably be a bloodbath much worse than Iraq because, you know, the ruling Shiites are a tiny minority.
Michael, we've got it. There's a view right from 30 miles from the Russian border in Ukraine. Tough view. One more right here. Anatole in Montreal, Canada. Anatole, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. You did not mention during the discussion the problem of NATO expansion. I was in the Western Balkans. Montenegro, and now the NATO alliance wants to incorporate also Bosnia-Herzegovina. The entire Adriatic coast from Croatia to Crete is under control of NATO powers.
And Russia has taken great offense at this. Where does that leave us, Anatole?
It means there is a pushback, a Russian pushback for 25 years. There have been attempts to contain Russia. Russia is reluctant to see a dominant sphere of influence which is not under its control, which is under NATO Western control. Hence, we have this problem. As far as presidential election, there are two candidates. One wants dialogue. The other one wants confrontation and destabilization. It is up to the American people to decide if they want a confrontation with Russia or constructive dialogue to prevent further radical terrorism and also to cooperate in the space race, which is an issue that Russia and America must have meaningful discussions
about. Anatole, I appreciate your call as well. Angela Stent, give us some advice here. What a range of options. You're watching. Americans are deciding. What's your advice?
Well, I mean, let's just go back to the two candidates. I mean, when Mr. Trump says he's going to go to Moscow and he's going to work out a deal with President Putin, first of all, you know, we're going to cooperate to get rid of Islamic State. If you look at what Russia has been doing in Syria for the past year, there's not very much evidence that they're very interested in destroying Islamic State. Their main goal is to make sure that their client, Assad, stays in power at whatever human cost. And by the way, they're using a playbook from the war in Chechnya when they leveled Grozny.
Level it.
So we have we have to understand that. So what would a deal mean? Presumably, and then this relates to the first caller, any deal with Russia would say, okay, we understand that Ukraine is your sphere of influence. You know, we're not going to do any more. We're going to back off. Ukraine will probably remain neutral. I mean, these are the questions which eventually, you know, people will have to ask themselves if you had a Donald Trump. Now, with Hillary Clinton, I slightly disagree with John Kornblum because I think that she would be tougher and be more involved, I think, with Europe and Russia than the Obama administration has been in the last year. But still, there are limited options there, too.
Wow. We're going to have to talk more about this. You two are great for being with us today. And let's do it again. I fear we'll have too many opportunities, but here we are. Angela Stent at Georgetown University joining us today from Washington. Angela, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
And John Kornblum with us today from London. He's based in Berlin with Noor LLP. John, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Great pleasure.
In a moment, the Philippines plays China off against the United States. This is On Point. Thank you.
The Philippines' new president, Rodrigo Duterte, is making things complicated for the United States and the South China Sea, threatening to pull away from its American ally and into the arms of China. To get a better understanding of what is going on America's Pacific flank, we turn to Murray Hebert. He's an expert on Southeast Asia and senior advisor and deputy director of the Southeast Asia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He joins us from Washington. Murray Hebert, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listen to a couple of things with me, if you would, with us for just a second here, Murray. This is China's official news agency, Xinhua, reporting this weekend that the Philippines President Duterte had urged the U.S. to stop using his nation as a quote-unquote doormat, and hinting, Duterte, that there were other great powers he could turn to for patronage.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte tells the United States not to treat the Philippines like a doormat, as he pleads for a little respect. The Philippine president said he did not want to antagonize the United States, but stressed that Washington should show some respect.
Implicit, maybe there China's an option. The language has been fierce from this new Philippine president. Last week, he again used some pretty aggressive language in speaking of world leaders, this time the U.S. president.
Instead of helping us, ang unang tumira itong State Department. So you can go to hell. Mr. Obama, you can go to hell.
Murray Hebert, what's going on here? This is a former American colony and then an ally for many years, fought with the Japanese. U.S. had enormous Navy base at Subic that they got out of in the 80s. But nobody ever thought of the Philippines flipping to become a Chinese client or ally. What's happening, Murray?
Well, he obviously uses extremely harsh language. He does carry baggage from dating back to the colonial period when there were some U.S. abuses in Mindanao.
To say the least. I mean, it was a very, very heavy fighting there and many, many local deaths.
Right. And so he's carrying some of that. He also is looking to balance out relations between the U.S. and China. As you know, the Philippines and China are having some disputes in the South China Sea over overlapping territories. But he also would like very much to get some assistance from China in building up the Philippine infrastructure, which he thinks would help develop particularly his home area of Mindanao.
I mean, is that possible? If China's moved aggressively into the South China Sea, but in a way, they would hardly need to if the Philippines became an ally. There's 1,000 islands all over this major sea traffic lane. Is this just rhetoric, or is it possible that you could see a Philippine shift to China alliance?
You know, this is a work in progress. We're trying to see what's going to happen. But you get the distinct impression that not everybody in the Philippines, including on his cabinet, is in exactly the same space that he is, that they want to, yes, get a little bit more independent from the United States, not depend only on the United States. But, you know, it's kind of bizarre that Duterte is going to visit China on the 19th of this month. And if he goes ahead and keeps blasting the United States, he, in a sense, weakens his position to negotiate with the Chinese. He won on July 12th. A UN arbitral tribunal ruled in favor of the Philippines on most of the disputes in the South China Sea. And yet he's willing to negotiate with the Chinese. But if he's so harsh on the United States, he in a sense weakens his position, I think, when he arrives in Beijing.
So American forces have been tossed out. Is that all the American forces that were tossed out recently? Who? What?
The only thing that has been formally announced is that the joint operations in the South China Sea will end for the rest of Duterte's 6-year term. There are also somewhere between 50 and 100 troops helping particularly with intelligence and the fight against the Abu Sayyaf, terrorists and kidnappers in his home province of Mindanao, that they're still there. And the defense secretary announced a few days ago that they will stay until Philippines is able to gather this intelligence themselves.
Mr. Hebert, describe the significance of the Philippines strategically. Subic Naval Base is not there, but it's also not in the hands of anybody else. Its relationship to the South China Sea has strategic significance for the United States, potentially for China.
Yes, I mean, the Philippines lies right on the southern flank of the South China Sea. There's a lot of disputes over islands. The role for the United States is that U.S. and Philippines agreed in 2014 that they would have an enhanced defense cooperation agreement, which would allow the U.S. not to return to its old bases, but to rotate through about a half a dozen bases. The U.S. would upgrade these bases. It would fly intelligence reconnaissance planes out of these bases, and that it would preposition supplies for typhoons, which regularly whack the Philippines at incredible velocity. So that we don't know what's going to happen with that. The Philippines has not yet said, Duterte has not yet said what he plans to do. But he did say late last week in all his shrill comments that he wasn't looking to abandon the U.S. alliance, but that he was just looking to distance himself.
What would he want from the United States? Or is this really just to get more aid from China? And if he got it, could he have that and the U.S. at the same time, have his cake and eat it too?
Well, the U.S. is open to that. They recognize that Philippines needs a lot of help on building its infrastructure. The U.S. doesn't have infrastructure money sloshing around, that the Chinese have a lot of money. They've committed with their new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, that it would be useful to have Philippines to have be able to benefit from better relations with China and maybe negotiate some of their differences if that can be done. Duterte has said that he will negotiate based on what the UN Arbitral Tribunal ruled in mid-July. China said we're not going to talk about that.
On
so
South China Sea. Really gonna,
In the South China Sea, yes, it's going to depend very much on how the first round of negotiations go. The other thing I should just add is that there's some increasing concern in Manila about some of the extreme positions that Duterte is taking, that he's speaking so in such harsh language about the president and the United States, and that he's also in the middle of a drug war, which there have been somewhere in the order of 3,500 extrajudicial killings since he took over in late June. And so he's really upset that the U.S. has criticized this policy. He says, this is what we got to do to get control of law and order. And the U.S. says, yeah, but you need to follow due process and rule of law.
Murray Hebert, so, please stand by there at CSIS. That's all we have time for today. But watch this space. Big motion, at least rhetorically, maybe more. Murray Hebert, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.